Greetings, race community. Brent coming in live with today's guest, Tom Chaves, who serves as Vice President for Advancement at his alma mater, Albright College, also known as a raving Mets fan. And we're in the midst of the National League Division Series, and the Mets won last night. So Tom is feeling extra good. And we're grateful to have you here, Tom.
Brent, thanks so much for this opportunity. And yeah, the timing couldn't be better. And I am an avid Met fan. It comes naturally. I'm from New York, from Queens. My dad was a New York Giants fan, a Willie Mays fan. And he tells the story when the Mets came back, when the Mets started in New York, when baseball came back to New York in 62, was the best day of his life. And he would always say, and I hold this still true, we root for two teams as a Met fan, the Mets and anyone playing the Yankees. And so we'll continue to do that. And hopefully in a couple of weeks, it'll be the same team we're rooting for, because maybe we'll have a Subway Series. So we'll see how it goes.
So you're a Royals fan and a Mets fan today.
That's true. That's true.
Well, you already started with a bit of your background, and that's where we usually start the show here. And so why don't you tell me more about growing up, and specifically, I like to talk about, let's say, junior year of high school. Who was that Tom? What was he into? And what led you to Albright College to study computer science and math?
Yeah, good time frame to probably start, because that's probably when, you know, my first interest in computer science, which is where my focus was in college. And Radio Shack TRS-80 computer cassette tape recording of whatever software we might have wrote back those days was my first exposure. And I really loved computer science and got to Albright College. They were starting computer science back then. And so that was of interest. It was Methodist affiliated. My dad's a Presbyterian minister by trade. Church was important to me. And so came to Albright and had a great experience. As a lot of people do, they grow up at college, and I grew up at college, met a lot of good friends, got involved with a lot of good things. I did do well academically, but it really allowed me to understand, you know, where my passion was in both personally and professionally. And so started after Albright as a programmer.
Hey, Tom, before yes, you dive in there, like when you think about technology, there are these periodic aha moments that we've all had where something goes from impossible to possible, or you never experienced and then you experienced it, and it starts to change your perspective of life and the intersection with the world. And so, like, we're living in one of those moments right now with generative AI, where a bunch of things went from possible to impossible. And most people have had some exposure to that over the last couple of years. When you think about your early interest in technology, were there equivalent sort of step function moments where you had those aha moments, even if they seem a little silly in hindsight? I mean, that's the way, you know, ChatGPT will seem to us you know, a couple decades from now. But like, what stands out as just being a big moment where you were like, wow?
Interesting question. And actually, what first came to my mind when you're asking this, Brent, is I still have at home, my wife wants me to get rid of a lot of stuff as we don't collect stuff. But downstairs, I have a grained image of my daughter, who was born in 1989, printed out from a computer. And, you know, it was, but you can still see her face. And I think that was probably one aha moment, right? Where a computer, machine can start to connect, you know, with real life, right? A person, right? And so that's the first thing that came to mind, maybe a little silly, but on a personal front. But, you know, on a more professional front, you know, I think as I started to get into my career, and so quickly spent a year at AT&T as a programmer, but came back to Albright a year after I graduated as director of annual giving. And what became evident there, one of the reasons I came back was they were going through a computer conversion in terms of the system they were using. And again, it probably an example of how computers can really, they're not just in the background, right? They can be part of an everyday life. And as we all know, advancements, relationship, business, how computers and technology can support that relationship business was probably an early aha moment for me, and continues to be an aha moment as I've, stayed in the advancement career. How those two can and should work better together to bring progress, to bring, solutions in the higher ed space, which is where I've been, but to any nonprofit, right? When you talk about the problems that they're trying to solve, whether it's cancer or leukemia, all the good things out there, how technology, data, systems, information can really help solve some of the big problems of the world. And I think I've constantly seen that through my close to 40 years of career. And that's what sort of comes to life.
I love it. I love it. And I think you should hold on to that printed picture of your daughter, by the way. So you can get rid of a lot of stuff. I'd keep that one, maybe frame it if it isn't already. But I'll tell you my version of that right now in 2024. I've got a 5-year-old. And one of the ways when you talk about integrating technology into real life, a lot of parents read to their kids before bed. We try to do that too. But now, one of our favorite traditions is writing before bed. So I love the ChatGPT mobile app. And the other night, I was sitting down and we just talk about our day, or we come up with ideas based on my son's friends or whatever's going on at school. But the other day, I said, "Hey, let's write a story. What do you think we should write about?" And he really likes the show Wicked Tuna on TV, tuna fishing. He's a big fisher.
Got it.
He said, "Dad, I have an idea. Let's write a story called Wicked Donkey, where my brothers and I catch donkeys instead of tuna." And I was like, "This is ridiculous, but I love it. This is what, creativity." And so I give a very basic prompt to ChatGPT, help my son Odin write a story about his brothers Gunnar and Soren, and the concept is Wicked Donkey. And we had a story 30 seconds later where the kids
Love
decided to put carrots on the fishing poles, go out to a
it.
farm, pass them in the middle of the field, and reel in, the wicked donkey. And it's like, and then I said, "Now give me an illustration." So that's what made me think of it, because it was your version of the printout of your daughter. And I had an amazing set of illustrations of, my three boys donkey chasing and, in a farm. Like, whatever, 20 years from now, that's gonna seem it's gonna seem silly, but at the time, it is just one of those moments where you seeing your daughter on a printout and me being able to have that experience with my son. And then I finished those experiences thinking, all right, so what are the implications for advancement? What are the implications for relationship business? If we can create and personalize and iterate in ways that were before possible, but really hard, right? I could have written a story with my son 3 years ago called Wicked Donkey, and maybe we would have gotten to the same place, but the friction in doing so, the time requirement would have prevented me likely from getting there. And so now it's accelerating our relationship building, right? We're spending more time on the valuable experience.
Love it.
And so there are going to be tremendous implications for the advancement world in sort of supporting the donor relationship building. We'll get into that, but tell me more about you're the young alum at Albright. You're going through an early conversion. Now I kind of want to know how many conversions you've been through, and do you have the all-time record in the industry? That's actually something I'm curious to know. But tell me about that early part of your journey.
Converting from a homegrown system at the time to a package system, Quodata was the one at the time. And it was a great learning opportunity. It was teamwork, right? Because I was partnering with the computer science people, staff, in my director of annual giving, technically fundraising role. But it allowed me to combine both and obviously learn the collaboration that's necessary in any kind of job and that kind of work, but really get into the weeds of how systems work, as well as start to highlight Albright's history of fundraising, right? I learned it quickly, looking at the data, right? Which was fascinating in itself. And so bringing together all those components really got me excited about, again, how all of this can really work together. And so Fast forward, I was at Albright for 4 years, and then had the opportunity to go to a software company that delivered software for college universities. And I was excited because not only was I helping, or did I help Albright, but now I'm able to help, a lot of institutions implement, systems. And there was a new system at the time. It's now the company called Ellucian. Back then it was called SCT. And I would say, I was there 17 years in numerous roles, but always kept my hands in advancement systems. I was involved with some of the other systems as well, financial aid and payroll and student, other things, but I would say always had a hand in the advancement system. And I would say I don't probably have the record of convert. I would say if I had to guess, I do say I think on my resume I've worked with hundreds of clients. And I know I have, but in different capacities. Some have been just a quick consulting gig. I would say in conversions, the number is probably 15 to 20 in terms of helping institutions directly with, the nitty-gritty of that. But I would say, probably closer to 100 of institutions that have converted and been involved at some level in a discussion with them. But spent 17 years at SCT, SunGard, what again now known as Ellucian, in numerous roles, ended as a general manager. And what that 17 years gave me is a lot more exposure to the business side, and a lot of different types of institutions, working with larger institutions, smaller, public, private. And so that those were great experiences to really widen my knowledge of, again, how advancement is helping all different types of institutions. And as much as people say everybody's unique and every institution's unique, I would say I saw the uniqueness in the types of institutions. I think maybe people over-exaggerate the uniqueness because there are similarities, but it was exciting for me to learn how different institutions are meeting the different needs of their constituencies. And even working with community colleges, right? My first exposure to community colleges was totally different than working with, a private liberal arts college and how they're focused. But what I enjoyed about that was the opportunity to see how these organizations are changing the lives of different types of students. So it gave me a much broader respect for education as a whole versus just, my alma mater, which is doing, good work in what they're doing. And so 17 years go by. And so as a lot of times as businesses grow, yes, sir.
Before you go to the next chapter, which I want to hear about, tell me about some of the most memorable experiences. I'm coming up on 15 years since starting Evertrue this coming February.
Congratulations.
So I'm not quite at the 17-year mark, but that is so rare, to be able to spend 17 years and to really go through, I think, multiple transformations of both your business, that business, but also from when you started, what was possible in technology to when you ended was another transformation because you started really just pre-internet. And then by the time you left, we were, all the way to social media, for example. And that's just an amazing kind of journey.
And so you're making me feel old, Brent, but you're right. I have seen a
All
lot of
right. I'm trying to
those
make you
changes.
feel wise, just to be
Thank
clear.
you. Thank you. Good way to put it. And maybe marketing hasn't always been my best suit in terms of how I can put things into perspective. But I do remember the first days at SCT where, we had a shared room where we had to check email. We didn't have our own, PCs and laptops. They were shared rooms. And I don't know if you had to schedule it, but you had to just go in there whenever and check your email, whatever email you might get at the time. When I left there, right? Everything's web-based and mobile-based and all that kind of stuff. And the transformations have been wild. And I remember working with SUNY State System was a big client of SCT at the time. There's 64 institutions. I think about 16 really adopted the platform at the time. And so I remember working with some of them and going out to them and helping them train on the system. And where they were coming from were paper-based systems. A lot of them were coming from paper-based systems. And so the conversion, right, was typing things in and such. And so those were just fascinating. And the amazement that people would have when they would see a green screen at the time of, wow, look at the profile of this donor or love all in one place. And like, and again, very archaic if you look at it now, but at the time, very new. And so, and I remember the different generations of going to the GUI interface, right? Graphical user interface, and then going to the web-based and then mobile, and all of those shifts. And again, this has been a blessing for me to be able to be in the middle of that and help others appreciate and what these different technologies brought and bring. And again, more importantly, how they can help solve the problems of the day, right? Every new or next generation of software solve problems better, faster, differently, or more problems. And I've been blessed that, my skill set of being able to one, see a problem and apply technology and help others do that. I have been blessed with that ability to do that. And that's where I've applied it over the years. And as these changes have occurred, I've been able to help more and more institutions do that. And so that's a little bit of a reflection on how I think about those changes.
So, what led you to make the leap to a client? I mean, you had a window into a whole bunch of universities. You talked about community college to private liberal arts, everything in between. And then ultimately, you not only joined Lehigh University, but had another really, really good run there.
Yeah, well, we all go through challenges in life, right? And I was actually part of a reduction in force back in, what would that have been? Got to get my math right, probably 2006.
So right around the financial crisis time period.
Yeah, and SCT at the time had tried to grow into different industries with their software. And it didn't work out as well. And so they had reductions and all sorts of things over probably a 2 to 3 year period, number of reductions. And I was part of one of those. And listen, at the time, if anyone has dealt with that, those are tough to deal with. But it did allow me to take a fresh look, right, at where I am in my career, in my life, and figure out what was next. And I remember talking to a good friend, good running buddy, actually, at the time. Who was a sort of a senior person at a financial company, and in chatting with him, I gave him my resume, and he said, "Tom, your resume is all about higher education, technology, blah blah. If you want to get into a different industry, you have to reshape, your resume and focus on your project management and your other skills that aren't totally higher ed if technology related." And so it really allowed me to think about, all right, what is next for me? Do I want to take my skills to another industry, whether it's product management or project management and consulting, or do I just want to go deeper, if you will, in the technology and the experience I had? And I decided to stay with the technology and the higher ed technology space. And so as I looked for my next opportunity, I started looking at, both companies, other software companies that support higher ed, but also in the nonprofit space. And I actually was doing some consulting on my own in the meantime because I still had to pay the bills. And at the time, my wife was also in consulting. And so, in the consulting world, you're a little, you're ebb and flow based on the business. And I actually was trying to get some work from Lehigh in the consulting firm I was at. I had some relationships there based on my previous. I was trying to generate some consulting work. Had a couple good calls, and then I remember the call would have been in 2008, I believe. And the one I was talk woman I was talking to, director of advancement services at Lehigh, said, "You know what? I'm leaving Lehigh and going on to something else." So I went home that night, talked to my wife. I said, "I think this is a great opportunity for me to get into a stable environment, into higher ed, and such." And long story short, I applied for the job and got it. And it allowed me to, get back to helping an institution, but a larger institution, being sort of a person to lead change at an organization. The technology at Lehigh and advancement wasn't as advanced back then. And so I had the opportunity to bring it to the next level. And so I did have a 9 year run there, ended as associate VP for advancement, I forget the exact title, but I basically had advancement services, I had annual giving, I had alumni relations, I basically had everything but major gift and corporate, and all that stuff. So, was able to make change with technology, again going back to the core of how technology can really help the organization and university move forward. Brought in a couple different systems, some integration, and brought information more to light with senior management. And I remember that, you know, when I was asked to join the cabinet of, it wasn't in the cabinet, I guess, but the senior leadership team of advancement, to me, that was a great breakthrough, right? Because before, all the technology was sort of, you know, an afterthought and down in the dungeon, if you will. And now that I was asked to be on the senior leadership team for advancement, having that perspective with the leaders of fundraising, that was a big moment for me personally, as well as I think for the career. I was heavily involved with AASP at the time. I did presentations on how I built that culture and that strategy to make data information more relevant to advancement services and have a seat at the table. I remember giving a session, how do you get advancement services a seat at the table? And I gave my Lehigh story as the example. So spent 9 years there. My boss, Joe Kender, he was VP. He moved on from Lehigh and went to St. Joseph's University. And so a year after he left, he gave me a call and said, Tom, what are you thinking? So I said, well, you know, things are okay at Lehigh, but, you know, well, he's come down, you know, we'll just chat, we'll see what happens. Well, long story short, he recruited me to join him at St. Joe's. And you know, St. Joe's, a great institution.
I
Yes,
want
sir.
to jump into St. Joe's, but I just got to say it was at that Lehigh part of the journey, and I love this, opportunities to connect with people like you on the podcast because we have known each other
Yeah.
for a long time, but it's also a catalyst for me to go back and think, how did I actually meet Tom? You know, when did we first really connect? And so the first time that you got on my radar was, I believe 2012 was the first year that I went to an AASP conference. I remember
Okay.
walking, and there was a newcomer's badge, and Vicky Medlock was there with a big smile welcoming me in. And then we started connecting by that way. And I'm pretty sure that along the way, it was either a Chris Pipkins or a Carolyn Chang
Yeah.
karaoke night or some other gathering where we actually got to maybe say hello. But that was a long time before we, did maybe any direct collaboration. But it's just kind of funny to think about the various intersection points with folks on the journey.
And, you know, two of those people you mentioned have been great colleagues over the years. You know, Caroline, Vicky, Chris, Gail Ferris, John Taylor. There's a group of us, to be honest with you, have been around for a while. And I'm not sure I was involved in the day one of ASP, but I was pretty much close to day one. And all those folks are involved and have been involved and has grown an organization. But and I would say, Brent, maybe it's a little bit of a tangent, but you know, the relationships you build in working in this industry are just immeasurable. And I tap them to this day. And I think occasionally I've even asked you, you know, from some information, a question from now to then. It's really probably not a formal engagement opportunity, but it's a quick question I might have that I tap into my network. And I value that. I obviously don't try to take advantage of that, but I think we all work together to help this industry become better because we all have a passion for how it can work, and how it could support the organizations that are doing great work out there.
Yeah, no, it's an amazing group. I got to just throw a Mike Riopel shout out while we're on that group. Mike was one of my kind of early mentors who helped bring us in, Mark Koenig, to that community as well. So you followed Joe to St. Joe's, and we did spend a little bit of time together when you were in that role. But just tell me about the before and after, what you're proud of, and then ultimately, I know you've been very involved with Albright along the way, so it felt totally natural when I saw the announcement about you making that move.
So, you know, the move to St. Joe's was about, you know, getting a larger portfolio and just getting more experience. And so I had more exposure to major gift work and such. And it was a smaller shop than Lehigh, so I was able to be hands-on. And I know in my career, I've often thought through, you know, pure leadership and management versus having, you know, my sleeves rolled up. And I've always been a hands-on guy at the end of the day. And so St. Joe's was a great opportunity for me to do both, to be again at the senior leadership table, but also have my sleeves rolled up and helping the teams be successful there. And again, a broader portfolio, bring more integration, if you will, from an operations perspective to for the success of St. Joe's and the fundraising program there. And so, yeah, along the way, I've always been involved with Albright, helped my reunions. I was on the alumni board. I ran through there. I was president of the Alumni Association. I think that ended in 09 or so. And then, I was asked to be a trustee in 2018-ish, 2017, 18. And so was privileged to be asked to do that. I joined the trustees at that time. And obviously, that's a very heavy engagement level, which I was happy to be involved with and help my alma mater, as many small liberal arts colleges are dealing with that pressure. And so that was a great experience. And so when the VP position came open at Albright, I'm like, and I've often thought over the years, can I be a VP? And not having a lot of direct fundraising experience, I've had some, but not direct. Always been on the operations side, if you will. It's like, can I do it? Can I fundraise? All that good stuff goes through your mind. And over the years, I'd read job descriptions of VPs. They always want the experience. You got to close a seven-figure gift. And, quite frankly, I haven't done that. So I'm like, I never really applied for a VP. And so when the president of Albright came to me and I had some board members encourage me to consider this, I'm like, maybe it's the right time, right? You become reflective as you get older. And I look at my career and talk through with my wife as well the pros and cons of this type of role. And obviously I took the role and started this past January, and I am thankful for it. It is a great opportunity. It's a great challenge. There are challenging times in higher ed, and Albright's got its share of challenges, and I know that. And we're dealing with them, but I'm enjoying that the more relationship side of the business, which I always knew existed, but now I'm doing that more than less. And I think because it's my alma mater and the passion I have and had and will always have for Albright, helps me be better at that than if it was just XYZ, university. And so I'm probably thankful I never went to a VP anywhere else, because I can really bring a lot to the table of my experience in advancement, in operations, access to fundraising, but obviously my passion for Albright and the challenges that Albright is facing. I believe I'm probably one of few, and I'm sure there are others that are qualified to do this for Albright at this time, but I do believe there's a right time and a right place for things, and I believe this is where I'm meant to be at this time to help Albright get through this time.
No, and look, you're not sugarcoating that you walked into some perfect situation. And so I'd
Right.
love to know more about just your candor around the current context you're operating in and how you balance acknowledging the issues while still painting an optimistic, pragmatic view for where things could go from here.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And being a trustee, I knew the situation I was walking into. And at a high level, the college, has had a couple of years where they've been operating in the red, and obviously knew that. And there were changes that were happening that was going to look to turn the corner for Albright. And this past year was supposed to be one of those moments where things were supposed to turn, and they didn't turn to the level that it needed to. And so, quite honest with you, a little bit more surprised after I got here than before. Not that anybody was hiding anything. I'm not insinuating that, but as time evolves, things happen and you learn more, and here we are. And our president stepped down in May, the one who recruited me, the one I was familiar with on the board. As more awareness became transparent to the board and others about some of the financial situations of the college, and so though that was though, that was a difficult moment, and I have shared that at some level. If it wasn't my alma mater, would I still be doing what I'm doing? Because there were tough roads ahead, and to the board's credit, they've stepped in. They've done amazing work to get a hold of what we need to do to make this turnaround happen. And they were doing work before as well, but when the president stepped down, they had to step in And quite frankly, in a very aggressive manner, we actually hired a turnaround president who joined us in July. This is her fifth college that she's worked with to turn it around, where there's been some financial duress and needing to make some difficult decisions, which include downsizing the organization, which will include reducing some programs. And you see in the press all the time, colleges either closing or merging or cutting. Well, we're in the cutting phase in terms of what we're cutting. And right now we're making those tough decisions moving forward. And my approach to life in general, and I'm applying it here, is you got to be transparent with your key investors and your key stakeholders. And so my fundraising right now is a lot of keeping people close and keeping people aware. And some people are stepping up and fund and supporting the college. Others are saying, well, no, let me wait a little bit to make sure Albright really gets through this, which probably next year's enrollment class will be a key milestone for Albright in this journey. We actually did have a decent first year class this past fall, so we feel good. That gets us along the way. But in order to really make everything sustainable, we need to grow enrollment probably by another 200 or so first year students. And we're at about a 360 student body. We need to get mid 400s to really make this a sustainable model moving forward. And we're doing a lot of changes to do that. All to say, being transparent about it with our top donors, with our middle class donors, not middle class, middle tier donors, and our annual giving donors, if you will, just being transparent about it, because there is people hear about things. And if you can't have confidence and if people don't have trust in what you're telling them, you're never going to get them to give. And so it is different than what I expected when I joined in January. But again, I've been very reflective of the skills I have and the experience I have, that I'm here for a reason, and I'm doing what I can to help Albright move forward in the philanthropy and engagement area.
But in the end, what it sounds like you're describing is being able to compete and win with another 100 or 200 students per year would be transformational. And so I'd love to just get your perspective on the intersection of advancement and enrollment, which are two of the primary revenue centers. In a turnaround context, because I would imagine, look, I know it's one university at a lot of places, but they're pretty siloed based on my experience. And I would imagine that you all have to be more integrated than most to get through this.
Absolutely. And the probably the easiest way to demonstrate that, and I'll go in more detail on other initiatives, is we're changing the board committees, right? We have an advancement committee and an enrollment committee currently. We're changing that to be a revenue committee that's going to be looking at both together, right? Instead of treating them separately. So that's going to be a tangible way that we're operating differently, at least with the board. But internally, yes, I'm partnering. I have been partnering. And listen, I knew we need to do this even before some of this. Been my philosophy. You got to work together in order to move the institution forward. And so every place I've been, I've looked to make that relationship stronger between advancement enrollment. But in a turnaround situation, even more so, right? And so we have our alumni board, for example, in the spring, right, when some of this was hitting, I engaged our alumni board to work with admissions, where we had people that were accepted but hadn't deposited yet. We had our young alumni reaching out, calling parents, calling students, and saying, hey, Albright is good, blah, blah, program, and blah, blah, blah. Gave them obviously the scripts. So that was one example of an early on engagement. And we're going to continue to do that with our young alumni group, whether it's college fairs or whether it's accepted student days and all those kinds of things. We want to get that engagement much closer with our advancement folks, excuse me, with our enrollment folks. And so that's one example. I've got a number, and I've seen this at other institutions, so it's not rocket science, but, and actually I can tell you back in the 80s when I came to Albright, this was happening with Albright, which is having alumni host summer send-offs, whatever institution call them, bringing the accepted students to, an alum house and get a couple alums there and just engaging that way. We want to do more with career, with alumni and such. The faculty is a great resource. They have stronger relationships than any advancement person will ever have with some alums. How do you make sure you leverage that and get that partnership even stronger? And so just doing what a lot of institutions have done, and Albright's had attempts at a lot of those over the years, but just trying to do even more of that and intensify it because of this situation of a turnaround and needing to focus on everybody rowing in the same direction at this point. And to the point where, from a fundraising perspective, right, we're not in a position in a turnaround to fundraise some pet projects, right, for an academic area, right? We're about fundraising unrestricted dollars, and scholarships fall into that category because of how institutional aid work. But fundamentally, we can't add more dollars to the budget right now, and fundraising's got to align with that. And that's tough because we know what an unrestricted, ask is a hard ask to donors as well. So how do we package that to appeal to the donors, but yet, realize and have the faculty support us in saying that, what, we can't do this pet project right now because, we really need to get, the operations a little bit more aligned.
No, it's interesting, and I love the idea of, how do you activate the alumni communities to support the enrollment objective? And you mentioned volunteer engagement, both via outreach, via events. And, one thing we can maybe real time brainstorm a little bit, but over the last few years, one of the concepts that we introduced to the industry was the idea of this DXO model, which was really an evolution of the leadership gift officer, except more of like an inside sales dedicated role with the idea of really prescriptive cadence-based outreach so that we could break through the noise and connect. And we really focused on, let's call it, mid-level donors who had been good supporters historically, but were also the most likely to lapse. They go either way, right? They lob in $500 or $1,000 one year, and then they forget to give, the next year. And we saw that, you said earlier, advancement is a relationship business. But the reality is that it hasn't been a relationship business for most. It's been a relationship business for a very small percentage, 1 to 2% of the giving pyramid, and then everybody else we've had to catch up via direct marketing, one to many, or more transactional approaches. And so we've seen a lot of success, and I feel like the whole industry is some form or fashion moving in that direction. But we've also had a handful of our customers reach out and say, "Brent, this works really well. Why don't we do it for enrollment? Why aren't we identifying the 300 people at the different stages of the enrollment funnel that they just came on campus? They did a visit, and how do we elevate
Absolutely.
their experience? Or they just got accepted, but they haven't done the deposit. What is the experience there?" It sounds like you're trying to get at some of that through volunteerism, but it just strikes me that in some instances, we've now elevated the donor experience for the $1,000 donor with a really high touch personal model, but the 30 or 40 or 50, or in some institutions, $80,000 a year tuition opportunity, we're still trying to get at through mass marketing. And it just strikes me as maybe being a disconnect. Tell me if I'm right, wrong, like how you'd modify it.
No, I think you're right. I think you're spot on. I would say, my exposure to, the enrollment technology space, I always thought that it was ahead of where the donor technology space was. But as I get closer to it here, at least, I'm not sure the technology might be there, but I'm not sure institutions are using it, right, to meet these needs. And that's exactly what's happening at Albright. We have decent software in the enrollment space here, but we haven't been using it. We rely on old methods, and the finger crossed method of, just, hoping that you'll get the right numbers. We need to use that in the enrollment space, and we did bring in a new leader this summer who has experience in that, and that's exactly what we're doing. And again, the good thing for Albright, we already had the technology, we just weren't using it. We don't have to invest in much at this point in time, at least, to get this turnaround in the right direction. Now, over time, there's probably more stuff we can do, I'm sure. But we had the fundamentals. We just weren't able to put them to good use. And that's the strategy that we're undertaking to get increase those numbers. Good. When you look at our numbers, we have over 6,000 applicants. We have over 4,000 that we accept. And right now, we're only yielding about 7.5% of those. That's not good. And we need to yield closer to 12 to 14%, if you will, which doesn't seem like a lot, but it'll make a big difference for a place like Albright that's heavily tuition driven. And in order to make those types of changes, especially in this competitive market where the number of students are less and all of those, barriers you have right now for any institution, you got to get smarter. You got to get more timely, and technology is a great way to do that. And so,
No, it is, but I think what we're hitting on and what we've learned and what I think you've just reinforced is it's the application of the technology, right? There's lots of things that technology can be used to do, but for me, the litmus test is that what's being done? And if not, how do you make the technology even better so it's harder to not do the thing that it was designed to do, but also how do you make sure that you wrap the technology with the right level of service or support to really create the accountability or the reporting to get there, right? Because it was hard for me to believe that that yield objective you're describing is unachievable. I suspect it's achievable. The way it's going to be achievable is frankly outcompeting the other institutions and creating a better enrollment experience for that original set of folks. And I think what you just highlighted is this is a fixed cost industry. All that revenue drops to the bottom line. And so I think that's where it's just, and we think about it the same way in the advancement side. And right, we got connected on just the idea of career moves. Like, how are we meeting their career inflection points and creating a quality stewardship experience that would improve their relationship with the institution, could lead to a follow-up conversation, could create career opportunities, could create corporate giving opportunities, could create annual giving opportunities or major giving opportunities, but it could also create none of those things if that insight doesn't lead to outreach that leads to a relationship, right? Then it's just data
Correct.
in a table, in a spreadsheet, probably not that different the way it was at SCT, 25 years ago. And so like that's, I think, what we're constantly coming back to, and I feel like there's got to be a version of that enrollment. It's not, do we have the data? It's, is it being applied and operationalized the way it needs to be?
I think that's spot on. And places like Albright, right? Small liberal arts, where resources aren't, as much as you'd always hope they'd be. I mean, right now, our employment data is very weak, and so we're going the old-fashioned way. We're going out and asking alums, right? I think it's either this week or next week, we're going out to alums and say, hey, would you be willing to do it? Provide an internship for a current student, right? And I'm hoping we'll get 10 people, and I'm sure we will, right? Because, and then we'll just start to build it and use the insight. So, and over time, right, next generations after me here will hopefully use that data even more strategically moving forward. And so I'm in a process of collecting it a little bit, and then putting it to use, if you will, the old-fashioned way. Our data isn't as rich as it should be. And that's, again, part of my experience knows I gotta, build that up as well, but to your point, make sure it's actionable as well.
Tom, I love talking to you. I always feel like I learned something. I know that we're coming up on time here, but there's a couple of things we've got to cover.
Okay.
One, you are an absolutely prolific runner, and I went and tracked down that in September of 2019, you and I enjoyed a run near the
We
Chicago
did.
River, I think around maybe an AASP conference back then. But why don't you share some of your running accolades in your humble way?
At the end of the day, I'm a simple guy, and running is a simple task, right? One foot in front of the other. And I ran in college. Actually, I ran in high school to get in shape to play basketball. And I remember after my senior year of high school, I worked out with my dad, and as much as he was a minister by trade, he also was in higher ed. And so I worked that summer with him, and we drove each morning out there. And he said to me, "Are you going to go out for basketball at college?" And I said, "Nah, I maybe intramurals, whatever." He said, "How about running?" And I'm like, "I never thought about that." And so, sure enough, that afternoon I call Albright, the coach, and got in touch, and I signed up for the cross country team. And I will tell you, that first week, I thought I was going to die. If Reading, Pennsylvania, for those who are not familiar, the hills in Reading, Pennsylvania, how naive I was back then, and maybe even so today. But I was at Queens, New York, flat, running. I ran 3 miles, 4 or 5 days a week. I thought I was, great. Well, I get to college. First of all, it's a 5 mile course, and the hills in Reading were like, oh my goodness. So we're running twice a day in camp, and I was about to die. Like, I can't do this. So I actually went to the coach and said, "Coach, I can't do this. I'm gonna leave the team." And he said, "You know what? Two a day workouts are done. It's Labor Day. You go home for the weekend, come back, start classes." And I said, sure. And I went home thinking, "There's no way." Anyway, long story short, I did it. I came back and ran cross country for 4 years. I loved it. And so long distance running got in my blood. And I remember my senior year of college, came down on a Sunday for Sunday brunch, and I'm watching the New York City Marathon. And Rod Dixon beat Jeff Smith that day. I won't bore you with the story, but Rod Dixon, it was a great duel to the end. Rod Dixon actually trained in Reading, and we had seen him during the cross country. So I felt I knew him, even though I didn't. But so New York, I'm from New York. It was a great duel, somebody I sort of knew. And I said to myself, "I'm going to run that marathon next year." And sure enough, I did. And I got the bug. I just love the race. I love the distance. I love the challenge. I love all everything about it. And so, long story short, a couple of years later, I after running a couple of marathons, or again fortunate to run New York and Boston for a couple of years, ended up saying, "You know what? I need a challenge around all this." And I set a challenge to run a marathon in every state. Was fortunate to be able to do that, and did that by the time I turned 50. At the heart, I'm a numbers guy, so I had a 50 by 50 by 50 goal, which was to run 50 states, 50 marathons, and 50,000 miles by the time I turned 50, was sort of my mantra. And sure enough, when I turned 50 in 2014, finished in Hawaii with my wife and 14 other friends, came with me on that last trip, and we celebrated my 50th state. It was actually my 100th marathon as well. Again, being a number geek, I made that all work as well. And so, very fortunate to do that. It was great experience, great way to see the country, learned a lot about the history of the country as well as, the marathon running itself. And so I've been very blessed with that. I continued running after that, running half marathons, ended up running a half marathon in half the states. And then unfortunately my knees didn't last. In 2022, my knees were like, "You know what? This isn't working anymore." And so I did hung up the running shoes. I started biking,
I
and
thought we were
for the
going to
last
say
2 years.
rowing. You're going to row 50 rivers in 50 states or something, but biking, all right.
Biking, and it's something I do with my wife. She's been doing, and actually the last 2 years we've been biking in some charity rides, which helps others as well. We've been very supportive of the MS Society, and so they have a lot of bike rides and gets us to travel a little bit, gets us supporting. So anyway, so that's been my health and exercise journey. But the 50 state journey was just great. Had a lot of great support over the years, and again, just a great journey to see the country that has so many nuggets of just pure joy and history, that it was great to learn about things that I never would have gotten to if I didn't have that journey.
Well, let's conclude on that note. New York Marathon, Boston Marathon, Chicago Marathon gets a lot of attention.
Yeah.
All right. What is the greatest marathon in the country that no one has ever heard of?
So, yeah, again, fortunate to run all three of those, and those are great experiences, the crowds and all the big ones. But I would say, I don't think this one exists anymore, but one I did, it was called the Paul Bunyan Marathon. It was up in Maine. It was a small one at the time. I think at the time I was running, it was like the 15th year of it. And it's the small town. These marathons are fundraisers for the towns, and so experiencing that, And being part of some small town interaction is great. I'll share one more that I do know is around in case anybody really wants to run one. It's a tough one. It's called God's Country. It's out in Counterport, Pennsylvania. It's run every July or June, I forget now. And again, it's a small one, but they do a great job. And it's a point to point. It's hilly, and it gets you, your heart pumping, obviously. But the town all comes around this race, and it's a weekend worth of events if you really want to spend the time. And the marathon is a big part of it, and it's just a great way to experience parts of the world that you and parts at least of the U.S. that you wouldn't have seen. And so it's God's Country in Counterport sometime in the summer. I forget exactly. I believe it's actually in June. So I would recommend that one for anyone looking to find a special one.
I love it, Tom. Well, the persistence and commitment that you have shown professionally maps pretty well to your consistency and persistence on the health and fitness journey. Thank you for sharing all of that with me. We covered a lot of ground,
Yes, we did.
and I'm grateful for the time. And I look forward to seeing you hopefully here at the AASB conference real soon.
Brent, thanks so much. I appreciate it. And yeah, look forward to seeing you and others who might be at ASP. So be well, and I'm sure we'll stay in touch.
Love it. Thanks. With that, I'll close today's episode with Tom Chaves, who serves as Vice President for Advancement at Albright College. Thanks, Tom, and take care, everybody.